Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
What's good, y'all? It's Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP, Sag Master, and now your host of Free Range. This is where NFL meets real talk. Every week, I'm bringing you inside the game, from locker room stories to league-wide headlines. You want football IQ, locker room insight, and real conversations with the people shaping the league? Welcome to Free Range with Von Miller, where nothing is off limits and every down counts. New episodes every Wednesday. Listen and follow Free Range with me, Von Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One on One.
I guess I'm most proud of the graduation rate that we had, and players went on to really do some really good things afterwards. You know, I've had a Rhodes Scholar play for me, tons of nurses, doctors, lawyers. That's cool to me. If I don't know about something, and I can always call somebody that knows about it that played for me.
And our guest this week is Harry Perretta, who spent more than four decades as the head coach of the women's basketball team at Villanova University, retired following the 2019-2020 season, won more than 780 games at the helm of the Wildcats. And coach, thanks so much for taking the time.
No problem. Thanks for inviting me.
So retirement, how's it treating you? How are you enjoying it?
Really a lot more than I thought. It's amazing. Like, I'm an exercise freak, so having a lot more time to exercise has really been cool. And it's amazing how you can find time to fill your day. I volunteered at a St. Bernadette's grade school last year, an hour a day for lunch. So it just was amazing how you found time during the day to fill your time.
Talk about the decision to retire. Had you been looking at that season, the 2019-2020 season, for a while, as that will probably be it? Was it something that kind of came up as maybe you just didn't have the drive that you had before? How'd it come together?
Well, what happened was, you know, my kids were in college. I planned on trying to stay till my second son, Michael, graduated. But to be honest with you, my body just started wearing out. I had gotten sick for a couple years, and my body just was wearing down. And I just didn't feel, from a physical standpoint, that I might not be able to hold up, you know. And Villanova was great about it. You know, they said, hey, you know, why don't you go ahead and do it? And they actually paid me for my last year of my contract, which they didn't have to do. And with the COVID, I was supposed to be like a fundraiser and stuff. And we didn't have a chance to do anything. So that's how it kind of worked itself out.
So growing up, was basketball always your top sport, or were you a kid that played whatever was in season?
Well, I was in grade school. I tried to play with whatever was in season. And then I just got hung up on basketball that my seventh and eighth grade year. I played at a school called Our Lady of Angels, which was in West Philly, and we moved after that, and I went to Bonner. I didn't really know anybody there, and I tried out for the team, and I was able to make the freshman team and all, and that's how it kind of worked itself out. I started playing basketball a lot, and then when I went to college, the best thing ever happened to me was getting hurt. I hurt my ankle really badly and couldn't play anymore in my freshman year, and I was going to try to play again. The coach came to me, goes, look, I know you want to be a coach down the road. And the head coach said to me, why don't you be the assistant JV coach in college and my assistant varsity coach? And I was like, yeah, I'd love to. So that's what happened. And then my junior year in college, the head JV coach left. So this guy gave me the job of coaching the JV boys and assistant varsity my junior year in college. So it wound up being the best thing ever happened to me, getting hurt and getting into coaching then.
It seems like, you know, a lot of guys, they get hurt and they can't play anymore, and it's devastating for them. Was there any time where you were like, I can't believe this happened? Or was that door opening to coaching, did that really kind of take all that away?
I think you're right. That I think it just took it all away. I'm a Division III basketball player. I wasn't going anywhere playing basketball. And I just said, you know, this is what my career path I wanted to be, was a coach. I wanted to be a high school coach, actually. And I said, man, I can't pass up this opportunity to get this much experience. You know, when I graduated from college, I had 2 years of coaching under my belt at a college level, which most people didn't have at that time.
You get that work at Lycoming. And I was going to ask you about this, about Villanova, but how difficult was it? I don't know if difficult's the word, challenging, being in a role as an authority when you're basically the same age as the players you're coaching?
I know. At the beginning, it was kind of a little bit rough, you know, but kind of worked it out where, hey, we all have to do a job here, players, coaches, and kind of worked it out where, hey, everybody just stay within what they have to do, and you got it done.
So you end up getting the job at Villanova in 1978. You're 22 years old. How in the world does a 22-year-old get a head coaching job at that age at a school like Villanova?
Well, it was really another break that I got. I applied for the job, and first of all, it was part-time at the time. So I applied for the job. I get an interview. Well, at the time, I didn't know the person that was interviewing me. Her name was Marianne Steenrod. She was the women's athletic director. I didn't know that her husband had played at Lycoming before I did. And it was unbelievable. So now she knows the head coach, Dutch Birch, and he gives me a great recommendation. And at the time, like I said before, I had more experience than the majority of people that were applying for the job, even though I was 22. I had 2 years of college coaching experience and no one else really did. And at the time, you got to remember the job was part time. So it wasn't a ton of applicants as you would think it would be now. So that's how I wind up getting it.
So when you take over, what are you inheriting? What is women's basketball at Villanova like in 78?
It's different. They had what was called, small college and major college, it was called. And at the time, Villanova was considered to be a small college job in terms of, ability. So, I got in there. I got lucky. I was able to recruit some local players. Back in that time, you know, recruiting was kind of regional. So if you were a really good player, you might be able to keep that player at home, which now is a lot harder to do. So what happened was I had gotten a couple players to stay home that lived in the area. And then all of a sudden it took off. And then by the time I was there, I think it was in my fourth year, we actually went to the Final Four, because we had all these local kids on the team. So it was really weird the way it was. Like, you couldn't do that today. It wouldn't work it ways. It wouldn't work itself out that way today. But back then, it's small college, major college, wasn't a big jump, and you recruited all these local kids, so you were able to get away with it.
I think you went 17-8 your first year. You mentioned in 82 you go to the Final Four. Did having success at that young age, was there any points where you're like, I can't believe I'm doing this, or did it just feel natural?
Well, you always kind of always feel like, I can't believe this is happening, you know? You always feel that way. And especially at the time, because when we went to the Final Four, there were established teams like Rutgers, Stephen F. Austin, you know, Cheney was big time then. It was just different, you know, like you're saying to yourself, I can't believe everything's falling into place this way.
And you mentioned that Final Four. I think that was a year or two before Villanova went officially Division I for women's basketball. Was it still AIAW then?
It was AIAW, which was Division I. It was just AIAW, and you had the NCAA. It just split that year. That year that we went to the Final Four was the first year that it split. And there were comparable teams on both sides. Like in our Final Four, I think it was Rutgers, Stephen F. Austin. I can't remember the other schools. And Cheney was in the other Final Four, which we had played that year. So they were pretty comparable to each other at that time. And then after that, the NCAA kind of took over.
So what were you like as a young coach? I mean, obviously you're having success, but how would you kind of describe your style, the way you interacted with the players, stuff like that?
I kind of did what I always did my whole career. I was friendly with the players on the team, tried to be honest with them as much as I could. I probably had too big of a mouth back then, too, like I did now. But Yeah, the interaction with the kids, I think, is what kind of made it special because, like you had said, we were kind of like the same age, but we all kind of understood what our roles were, which I thought was really cool. And I don't know, it's a lot harder to do today, I think, than it was 40-some years ago.
And just, I want to backtrack that the ankle injury you had, is that something that if you had it today, it wouldn't be nearly as big a deal, or was it something that was going to be kind of catastrophic no matter what?
Well, I don't think it would have been catastrophic as much today. I could have played again, but, you know, I was still having problems with it. And then when the coach approached me and said that, I said, you know something? I don't see the reason in what am I going to accomplish, you know, by playing Division III basketball. I can accomplish more by coaching Division III basketball.
So you were part-time when you start your career. You must be doing something else to make a living, right?
Yeah, I was a laborer for a guy that, you know, does cement work. So that was the first year. And I was telling the story about the first time I ever met Dave Gavitt, who founded the Big East. I had just come from work and we were at practice, and Rolly Massimino was brought Dave Gavitt out and Mike Trangisi to meet me. And I still had my work boots on from the day, you know, shoveling cement and everything. So it was kind of really a cool thing. Like, you know, you go from laying cement in the morning and then in the afternoon I go to practice. And then the first time I met Gavitt, he's looking at me like, are you kidding me? You know, so it was just so different back then, but fun.
How much of a challenge was it just logistically as you're part-time, but it's not just practice. You got to travel for games. I'm sure there was some overnights and stuff like that. How tough was that, just getting everybody to sign off on you missing work and stuff like that?
Yeah, the first year was easy because the guy I worked for was independent contractor. The second year I actually taught school. I taught at St. Monica's down in South Philadelphia. That was a little harder because I had to tell them ahead of time when I was going to be missing days, and also getting out. Some days I had to let my class out early because I had to either get to practice or get to a game. So the second year was a lot harder than the first, but luckily, the people that were around me worked with me.
How long until the job at Villanova became full-time?
Third year became full-time. I remember because I was making $8,500 teaching and $4,000 coaching. And then I remember Villanova offered me a job at $12,500, and I thought I hit the jackpot. So I wound up, that's when I became full-time. But it's just really interesting, the dynamics of it then.
How much of a hand did you have in those early days in the schedule, stuff like that? Or was it just, you were just handed, this is who you're playing this year?
I had a hand in it, you know, just like you do now. You know, we would go through it, over the summer, try to schedule a decent schedule. So, you know, I always had most of the control over that.
So let's talk about, when it goes from AIAW to the NCAA running everything, to the layperson, does it look any different? Does anything change, or is it just everybody's under that same umbrella?
Nothing really changes but the rules. And then you go under the big umbrella, the NCAA. A lot of the rules, not a lot of the rules, but some of the recruiting rules were different. AIAW, you were allowed out to go see players more. NCAA had more confined, you know, and when you can get out and go recruiting, but really wasn't that much of a difference.
So I'm curious, you spend 42 years as the head coach at Villanova. I don't think anybody takes a job, you know, when they're 22 and says, I'm going to be here for the rest of my career. Do you remember, was there a certain point where you kind of took stock and said, hey, you know what, I got it good here, and it's going to take me a lot to get out of here. I think I could ride this one for a long time.
Yeah, I remember actually it was probably like 19 years before I retired. I had a really good team. Trish Jaleen was local, and that was a team that beat UConn, but we hadn't done that yet. And a school came after me. You know, the money was really remarkable, and I remember it vividly because I went up to see the president of Villanova. His name was Father Dobbin, to talk about, you know, what was going on and all. And I remember, like, as I was talking to him, I said, Father, you know, I'm at a crossroads, don't really know what to do. And I wasn't talking to him as much as he was my boss, as if he was my friend, you know. And I said to him at one point in the meeting, I said, Father, you know, what do you think? Like, tell me what you really think. And this is a true story. He says, Harry, he goes, I think you should go back to your office. He goes, I don't think you're going anywhere. So I just got up and left. I said, I'll see you tomorrow, Father. And that was it. And when I did that, I went back to the office. My wife was waiting for me and Vince Nicastro were waiting for me. And that was the point I felt like I never would leave Villanova. It was just like a special place for me. And, you know, that was the exact time that I thought that I would never leave.
Talk to Lemmy a little bit about your coaching style with regards to what you guys would run on offense. Kind of describe it and tell me where you, what is it based in? Who were kind of your influences?
Well, we run a basic motion offense, and it's a basically, people call it equal opportunity offense. I call it an offense that we try to help get players who are not as talented shots, and the players that are talented, we help them a little bit, but they can also help themselves. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of like the philosophy of it. And I basically had that philosophy because I was always a very average player. I was never super talented. And I felt like we have to run some kind of offense to help players help themselves. And that's kind of how it all started with me. And that was my coaching style. And hopefully if we had great players would just make everyone else better. And I remember, I don't know if you saw that special on Michael Jordan that they had done ESPN. Mm-hmm. One of the things that stood out to me was that a lot of times very talented players don't want to play in motion offenses because they think it's equal opportunity. And I remember in that special, when Jackson took over the coaching at Chicago, they viewed the triangle as equal opportunity offense. And Jordan was a little skeptical of that. Well, the reality is there is no such thing as equal opportunity. I mean, if you're a talented player, you're going to stand out. And that kind of reminded me when Jordan bought into it, he was able to help the other players get better. And the offense itself didn't stand in Jordan's way. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of like what I thought of when I saw the special. And that was my philosophy towards coaching was, hey, if you're a great player, you can do all these things within the offense, but we want to use the offense to help the ones that are not as talented.
I'm curious, when you become a head coach at such a young age, and you mentioned you stayed local recruiting, was recruiting overwhelming to you at first, or was it something you always felt like you had a knack for being able to see players who not just were good, but were good at what you wanted to do?
Well, it was kind of like a twofold thing. One is I thought recruiting was easier than it really was because at the time, I told you, local players played at local schools. When that started to change, that's when recruiting got really hard because then you had to go out and find players different parts of the country. I don't think it's hard for a coach to pick out players who fit their style of coaching. I think that's not a real hard thing to do. Now, getting them to come to your school might be a hard thing to do, but I think you can always find kids that fit your style. But like I said, at the beginning, I thought recruiting was easier than it really was. And then I found out when things started changing and everything became more national, I found out it was a lot harder to do.
Did you enjoy the recruiting process, or was it a necessary evil?
It was kind of a little bit of both. I tried to make myself enjoy it because I looked at it as even if I didn't get certain kids, I got a chance to either travel to a different part of the country, meet people from a different part of the country. And it's amazing how many friends you make all around the country. Because sometimes even if we didn't get the kid, you kind of stayed in touch with their family and stuff because you got to know them through the recruiting process.
So when we talk about your success, you mentioned that Final Four team in 82. What was that ride like, going there? And was that a team that, if I talked to you prior to the season, you would have said, I don't know if you say we're going to be a Final Four, but you would say we're going to be really good. We got a chance to do something special.
I knew we were pretty good. I had had some local. I had gotten Kathy Beisel, who was one of the best, who was top three or four player in Philadelphia. The following year, I had got Nancy Bernhardt, who was one of the top players in the Philadelphia area. Stephanie Gately, or Stephanie Vanderslice at the time, was a top player out of Ocean City High School. And she had transferred from Delaware. She had gone to Delaware first, transferred to Villanova. And then we had another kid named Lisa Ortlip, who was a very good player. So I knew that those kids were pretty good. I knew they were pretty good.
And what's the ride like that season?
It was really cool. Like, winning the games were really cool. The only thing that was funny about it, the AIAW Final Four was in Philly. It was at the Palestra. So we didn't get to travel anywhere. But it was kind of cool beating some of the teams to get there.
You've had a lot of great players come through, and I think maybe the greatest you had that came right after that Final Four team, Shelly Pennyfather. Tell me a little bit about her.
Well, that's a unique story. This was a kid who normally would not go to a Villanova. She would go to either a Tennessee, a UConn, you know, a Louisville, a South Carolina. But because Shelly was so religious, she only looked at three schools. They were Providence, Holy Cross, and Villanova. So because of that one aspect, we automatically had a shot at her. And, you know, somehow, some way, her and I really hit it off. And we both of us had a devotion to the Blessed Mother. I say the rosary every day. And we kind of hit it off that way. And she wound up coming to Villanova, which was really cool.
School's all-time leading scorer. What made her such a special player? Like, what, for people that, you know, weren't able to see her, what made her who she was?
Well, she was extremely unselfish. She's very intelligent, knew how to play, very talented. And to give you a description, the late Dave Gavitt called her Larry Bird of women's basketball. She's like, that's the kind of player she was. Could shoot it, could handle it, could rebound, could pass it, made everybody around her better. So that's kind of best description I can give you. That, you know, she was like a Larry Bird of women's basketball.
And after she got done playing basketball, she had a calling, became a nun.
Mm-hmm. She came back from Japan. She went to Japan, and they made her the highest played women's basketball player in the world in 1991. And when she came back from there, she just came in to see me and said, "Look, I have this calling that I want to join this order." This religious order, which was a Poor Clares. And, you know, at first I was kind of taken back because I thought she would be a religious, but I didn't know whether she would be that strict of an order. I mean, this order, you know, you only talk, I think, for an hour a day in a community. You don't eat any meat. You sleep 4 hours at a time. You sleep on a bed of straw. I just didn't think it would be that she would go into that kind of order where you don't really see anybody. Everything they do is based off the power of prayer. So we went down to the monastery and we met Mother Superior. She took me with her, and one thing led to another, and she wound up being a cloistered nun.
How often do you have contact with her?
Yeah, that was one of the special things. Like, I managed to make a deal with Mother Superior. I'm the only non-family member that gets to see her once a year. Her friends that, whatever, we all saw her 2 years ago. She had a 25th anniversary. We actually could see her then and talk to her. But normally, only her family gets to see her three times a year. And I was able to go and be, you know, see her once a year since she went into the place.
You mentioned the 2002-2003 team that beat UConn. And that's a team that went to the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament, really had a ton of success, a fun team to watch. Once again, kind of before we talk about the specifics of the success, if I talk to you prior to that season, are you feeling pretty good that this team's got what it takes to put something together?
Yeah, I thought we were pretty good again. Obviously, I didn't think we were better. You know, we were able to beat UConn. But I thought we were pretty good. I thought we were an NCAA team because the year before, I think we were ranked 20th in the country and we had the same team back. So I felt like, you know, we were an NCAA team, maybe win a game in the NCAA tournament, maybe win two if we were lucky. But I thought that we had the right kind of kids to be pretty good that year.
And you mentioned the UConn. That was the Big East championship game, March 11th. I think it's at Rutgers, if I'm not mistaken.
It was at Rutgers, correct.
UConn, and everybody knows, you know, what UConn is now is what UConn was then. I think they had won 70 games in a row. And I've talked to you before, and you've told me a great story about the bus ride in to play that game. And we talk about Shelly Pennyfather. Talk a little bit about what transpired as you guys are getting ready to try to slay the UConn Dragon.
Yeah, it's a really great story. And what made it even funnier was that Doris Burke told the story on ESPN before the game started. And the story goes like this, that we were on the bus driving over to the game and my cell phone rings and it's Mrs. Pennyfather. And the reason she was calling me was because CBS was wanted to do a special on Shelly, and they wanted to interview Mrs. Pennyfather. And Mrs. Pennyfather, very, very, laid back. She doesn't really want to talk to anybody kind of person. And she had called me on the phone, just happened to call me at this time to say, Harry, I made a decision. I don't want to talk to CBS, but my kids will. So this is literally on the bus ride over to the gym. And I'm like, okay, Mrs. Pennyfather, no problem. She goes, what are you doing? I said, well, actually, right now I'm on the bus getting ready to go over and play UConn for the Big East Championship. And she started laughing. She goes, oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, blah, blah, blah. She goes, what I'll do is I'll call the convent and I'll leave a message that tell them to pray for you to win the game. So we get over to the game and see Doris Burke before the game, who's announcing the game. She's friends with Shelly from before. Asking how Shelly's doing. So I tell her the whole story about the bus ride. So after the game's over, I guess she told the story on national television. And what makes the story even more funnier was that summer, I went down to visit Shelly. And when I walked in, she's like, Harry, did something happen that I don't know about or whatever? I said, what are you talking about? She goes, well, back in March or whatever it was, April, February or March, she said, we had people knocking on the front door that wanted to talk about, the basketball game. And Mother Superior was like getting very angry. You know what I mean? She said they also were getting phone calls. You don't talk to anybody there. You leave a message. She goes, there was messages on the machine from different coaches, from different high school teams and college teams saying, would you please pray for us to win the championships? So I told her, I said, look, sister, I said, this is why it happened. I said, because Doris told the story on national television. So that was what made it even more funnier.
Time for a break on One-on-One. We will have more with former Villanova women's basketball coach Harry Perretta right after this.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
What's good, y'all? It's Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP, SAG Master, and now your host of Free Range. This is where NFL meets real talk. Every week, I'm bringing you inside the game, from locker room stories to league-wide headlines. You want football IQ, locker room insight, and real conversations with the people shaping the league? Welcome to Free Range with Von Miller, where nothing is off limits and every down counts. New episodes every Wednesday. Listen and follow Free Range with me, Von Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back, continuing our conversation with retired Villanova women's basketball coach Harry Perretta. As far as the game's concerned, you guys are very good. UConn has, though, this aura of invincibility. What are you thinking going into this one? Because you had played them during the regular season, and they beat you, but they didn't beat you like they beat most teams.
Well, they beat us by 20. And it was funny, we were only down 9 with I think it was like 9 minutes to go in the game at UConn. And then they wound up hitting a couple shots, breaking it open. But the funny thing is that you mentioned that was, and I said to Joe Mullaney about after the game, we're riding home on the bus. I said, you know something, Joe? I said, I know you think I might be crazy. I said, but it wouldn't be impossible for us to beat them on a good day. I said, because they're nowhere near as good as they were the year before. The year before, they beat us by 50. And they had 4 kids that went to the WNBA first, second, third, and fourth draft choices. That's how good they were. So it was funny. I said that to him. I said, I don't think it's impossible. I said, is it hard? I said, yeah, but I don't think it's impossible. And the funny thing was, when we beat them, we were down 9 with 9 minutes to go. I'll never forget it, at Rutgers. And Nicole Druckenmiller hits 3 threes in a row on 3 possessions. Now the next thing you know, the game's tied. And then we wound up going up like 4 or 5 and then holding on at the end. But it was really strange how you brought that up, that, you know, we felt like going into the game that we could win. The year before, the kids knew they couldn't win. It's a big difference.
What is it like coaching down the stretch in a game like that? I would imagine how much of it is strategy and how much of it is just staying in the kids' heads. Let's stay on point. They're human just like we are. Let's run our sets. We're going to do our thing. What's the balance in a situation like that?
I guess it's mostly like 50-50, you know, like you have to be able to use strategy, which we were trying to do. Like ESPN was, when they broke the game down, there was no 10-second violation that back then, you know, for the backcourt. Well, we were taking 15 seconds just to get it over half court because we were trying to kill the clock as much as we could. So that strategy, and like you said, keeping the kids focused on, hey, focus on, like I kept telling them, don't worry about trying to win. Just try to do what the best play is. Try to make the best play possible. I said, you can't worry about just winning and losing. I said, you'll lose focus that way. So that's all we were trying to do down the stretch, was I was trying to keep in their heads about, hey, you know, focus that way. And I was trying to pick out things that we could run on offense to try to get an easy shot.
Do you remember the moment when you looked up and you kind of processed time, score, situation, and you were like, we're going to do this? Like, did you allow yourself, or was it not until it's 000s and the ball's in the ref's hands, am I going to accept that we're going to win this?
I'll tell you, it was really funny because the game was in doubt up until 2 seconds to go. They got called for a walk on an offensive rebound. We were up 4. They were about to lay it in to make it a 2-point game and press us. They got called for a walk. And at that point, I said to Joe, I said, we might win. And then we just threw the ball in bounds and they didn't foul us and the game was over. But it wasn't until like 2 seconds ago that I felt that way.
The celebration, the next 24, 48 hours, Villanova women's basketball is everywhere. You're getting calls and requests from all over the country, if not beyond. What is that like? What is that, you know, the 2 days after that like?
That's exactly what it was like. You just said it was like calls from everybody. You really didn't sleep very much. You didn't care, though, at that time. And then you're talking to all these different people. People are calling you. And what's really funny was it was after the tournament was over, the NCAA tournament was over. And I was talking to Pat Summitt, and I was like, you know something, Pat, I don't think I could ever go through that again. In terms of, I said, I don't know how you and Gino do this. I said, I have no idea. I said, I couldn't do this on a regular basis. I would quit. And because it was like so different, like the time is never yours, you know? And I just thought that was an interesting thing. And like Gino and Pat were both my friends, and I was able to talk to them about it. But I remember that, and the kids knew it too. Like there was some, those kids and I got along really well, and they knew that I hated all this publicity stuff, you know? And one of the great stories was we had just beaten Colorado to go to the Elite Eight, and you know, we go to the press conference and all that stuff. So Trish Jalene walks by me. We're out in the hallway. And Trish says to me, we're really pissing you off now, aren't we? Because they kept winning. Because she knew I hated it so bad. And so it was so funny. Like, we had a great rapport, you know?
I'm curious, when you beat UConn and you mentioned Gino's a friend, did he say anything to you after the game? Or was it just simply, hey, congratulations, best of luck? Do you remember any conversation there?
He was joking with me and all. And then he said to me, yeah, he goes, you stopped me from being immortal. Cause they were talking about them breaking UCLA's record, you know? So, you know, it's fun to have somebody that's your friend that understands. And, you know, he was pretty good about it.
And I'm curious, you guys make the run in the NCAA tournament. How much, after you win a game like that, and the program is on a pedestal, and everybody's focusing on it, did you feel any extra pressure going into the NCAA tournament, specifically in that first round? Because I think St. Francis gave you some fits in that first round. And absolutely. Do you feel like we can't beat UConn to win a conference title and lose in the first round of the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, it was different for us. You know, we were never in a position of being a favorite, you know. And I wasn't very much in, like, it wasn't since we had Shelly Pennyfather and Stephanie Gately and all those guys that we were always a favorite. Since then, we were always underdogs, and it did add a lot of extra pressure. I remember those first couple games, the first game, the second game. I remember how I felt. It was different than the way I felt before, because we would always be an 8 seed or a 10 seed or something like that, and you don't feel much pressure in those kind of games. But you're correct. You did feel some pressure. And I remember Dave Gavitt, again, I always reference him. He told me a long time ago about our style of basketball at Villanova. He says, look, Harry, he goes, your style of basketball at Villanova will give you a chance to upset teams. He says, but remember something. It also will give teams the opportunity to upset you. He says, because the way you play, you're not blowing people out. You're always keeping teams in the game. He says, so just remember that. And he was right. And he said to me, he goes, look, I'd rather do it the way you're doing it too, because you'd rather be able to try to beat somebody good. But he goes, but always remember, you're letting other people in the game too.
You get to the Elite Eight that year and you play, you mentioned Pat Summitt, you play Tennessee. What was it like for that group to within, I don't know, what the date, 3 weeks, within 3.5 weeks of each other, you play at what are at the time the two elite cornerstone programs in the world in women's basketball in UConn and Tennessee?
Yeah, it was cool. And the thing that made that cooler was the summer before that season is when Pat came up to Villanova to look at our offense and study our offense. And Trish Jolene and all those guys got to meet her and everything. So they all knew her. And, you know, so it was kind of neat that, you know, people within the league all knew each other with Connecticut. And then we knew people at Tennessee also. So it was kind of cool for myself and the kids on the team, like you said, to be able to play against the two, you know, highest programs in the country or in the world at the time.
Just kind of going along with this, and you kind of referenced, you know, what it was like after you beat UConn. You lose to Tennessee in the Elite Eight. How exhausted are you when it's all over, that season's done?
Yeah, I was really exhausted. I mean, I just, like, basically for the next 2 weeks, just, like, didn't even go into work, just tried to relax and just try to get my body back from the stress that it was under from the tournament, you know? And that's why, like, I always give so much credit to, like, a Gino, a Pat, Dawn Staley, all those guys, because I don't think that people realize the pressure that they're under on a day-to-day basis. Like, I felt that pressure for one season, maybe two, in my whole career, and I almost quit coaching. You know, so it's amazing what it does to your body just in terms of stress, you know.
I was going through getting ready for this and reading some articles written about you over the years, and I saw something that you preferred practice to the games. Is that true?
Absolutely. I hated the games. Practice to me was always the fun part, teaching kids and, you know, everybody playing hard and having fun, and we joke around and practice. The games, like, kind of interfered with that sometimes because, you know, you have – not that you have to win, but people want you to win, and they're always talking about, are you going to win, and people, how many minutes playing time. Like, all that stuff would get all into it. Where we're practice, you never worried about that stuff. You just kind of, like, did your thing, prepared, practiced, had fun, played hard. But, like I said, the games always interfered with that for me.
From when you started Villanova to when you retire – it seems to me, as on the outside, as someone who's watched and covered, women's basketball has made a stratospheric change. As someone who was on the inside, how did the game, everything surrounding it, the attention, how much did that change over the 4+ decades you were head coach?
Well, it changed dramatically. I mean, just the media coverage is what changed the most, I thought, from the first years that we started. You know, the more publicity you got, more people got more interested in women's basketball. And then more people started playing women's basketball, I think. And then we started spreading out the talent around the country. And then what happened was, like it did in men's basketball for a while, the teams that had the most money, the biggest budgets and things like that, they were the better teams. Where in the old days, again, with the local stuff, a local team could be really good without having a big budget. So those were like the biggest changes, the media stuff and the budgets being put into some of the bigger programs. And I think that those were the biggest changes.
How about the X and O's of the game?
X's and O's, I think nowadays everything is more talent-based X's and O's, which I mean is more about the players making plays. Pick and roll, you know, post up, ISOs. So it's more about that. Years ago when I first started, I think it was more about everybody wasn't as super talented. So we kind of like, you know, felt like we needed to do more motion, more back screens, more flare, like different kinds of things. Today, I think it's more talent-based offense.
And I'm curious, we talked about when you start, you're 22 and you're so young. Do you remember a point where you started to not think of yourself as a young coach anymore?
Yeah, I don't really remember when I did. That's an interesting question because I've said to myself many times, like, at what point did I actually feel like I was like really involved in coaching, you know? Because when you're 22, you think you're just way too young. And then when you're 60 something, you think maybe you're too old. But like, I don't remember the exact time where I started saying, wow, like I'm established now. Because you have to remember something. When I took over, I was around Rolly Massimino, Dave Gavitt, Joe Mullaney Sr., John Thompson, John Chaney. I met all these people, you know what I mean? Chuck Daly, Billy Cunningham, because they were friends with Rolly. And through him, I met all these people. So to me, I was always the kid. I always thought of myself as the kid, you know, the kid that sat in the corner, kept your mouth shut and paid attention. So for a long time, that's the way I thought of it for a very long time.
And you mentioned Rolly and then obviously the success Jay Wright's had. You know, what was it like kind of working with a program next to icons like this, you know, coaches that won national championships and stuff? And what did you learn from these guys?
Well, like I said, learned the most from Rolly because, you know, you're young at that time. And, you know, I learned the most from him. And the good thing about all the people that I mentioned, they always included you. It was so different. I don't know if it's different, but I don't want to compare then and now. All I know is they would include me. Like Rolly would have me in his meetings, in his office. Chaney would invite me to his practices, things like that. I mean, my relationship with Jay was always very good, but it wasn't like it was back then. Like back then, like you literally hung out with each other. As things went on, you didn't do that as much anymore. You talked a lot, like Jay and I would talk a lot during the day, but it wouldn't be as much on the court type stuff. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
It's more like, hey, how you doing? You know, what do you think of this? What do you think of this kid? Blah, blah, blah. But in the old days, it was like crazy. You know, like I remember, like I would be at Rolly's practices and we would be discussing like the flex offense, like right in front of the team. And then, you know, I'd go to Chaney's practices and we would be discussing something on the court. Like you just don't do that today. Like I remember Larry Brown inviting me up to the Sixers training camp when he had Iverson and those guys. He brought me on the court to show him our zone offense at Villanova with Iverson and Coleman and those guys. Like you just don't do that anymore, you know? So that's what made it like a golden age for me with those guys.
You've mentioned all these great basketball names, Philadelphia area and beyond, that you've had the opportunity to work and deal with and become friends with. Is there anyone over your career that, you know, you would put at the top of the list that you were just kind of the most wide-eyed that you were able to get access to and treated you as a peer? Was there anybody that you would have moments like, I can't believe I'm talking to this coach?
I would always say that about Rolly because that was the first guy. Like, here I am, I'm 22 years old off the street, and he doesn't have to even say boo to me if he doesn't want to, you know? And he took me in and made me, he just made me one of his family, you know? So that was always the big one, you know? Now, the other people, I would be sitting at Chaney's practice saying to myself, like, I can't believe John Chaney asked me, you know, but I didn't know him as well. Larry Brown when he invited me to the Sixers training camp. So John Thompson, when we were down at Georgetown, you know, back in the day, like those guys didn't talk to any outsiders, you know what I mean? Or many outsiders. And when we would go to Georgetown, Thompson would talk to me and people would be like, he talks to you? They couldn't believe it. I said, well, I kind of, my associate head coach, Joe Mullaney, his father coached Thompson at Providence. And through him, I got to be friendly with Thompson. So it was more Rolly was like the guy on a day-to-day basis. You know what I mean? I think that's the best way to put it.
What was it like being a part of the Big Five and playing Big Five games?
It was really weird. And it was really funny because I said something to the president. We had a dinner about 3 months ago. And I told him, I said, Father, I said, I always wanted to win a Big Five game more than I wanted to win a Big East game. And he was like, well, you know, he's yelling at me and all. And I was like, to me, it was like the old days. I got that meant more to me than the Big East. And I was always a member of the Big East, too. But the Philadelphia games just meant a lot to me for some reason.
And to that point, and I think I know the answer, but I'd love to dig into one of those. How much did you relish being a part of the Philadelphia basketball community beyond just the Villanova?
Well, like I said, it was really cool. Like, I was playing, we played golf in the spring with Jimmy Lynam and Herbie McGee, who I had known for years back in the day. And it's just like a really cool thing that you're talking to all these people on a regular basis. And to me, that's what made it really special for me. Like all these Philadelphia basketball icons that I was able to associate myself with and learn from, like you said, and, you know, get bits and pieces from everybody. So to me, it was really, really cool that I could call up, you know, somebody and say, hey, like I was down at LaSalle in the summer. I think we went down in June and I gave a clinic to the men and women's team at LaSalle. So that's kind of like a cool thing to do for me.
What do you miss about not coaching now being retired? Are there big things you'll sit back and go, man, I wouldn't mind doing that one more time or stuff like that?
Practices are still on my list. Like last year, I couldn't really go to anybody's practice because of the COVID. I missed it even more. Now this year, I think hopefully I'll get my fill by being able to go to some team's practice. That's what I miss the most. Like I'm going to volunteer assistant for one of my former players at a Division III school this year. So she just got the job. So that'll enable me to go to practice two or three times a week. And that I think that'll really satisfy whatever urge I had that I missed that.
And you mentioned, you know, because of the pandemic, things were weird. But were you able to watch any Villanova last year, even on TV? And was it weird?
You know, it wasn't as weird as I thought it would be. I saw most of the game. I saw all the games either on the computer or live. I could go to some of the games live. And it was a little bit weird, but not as much as I thought it would be. It was really interesting because I had told you before, I was so happy not to be down there on the court coaching the game that I didn't miss it that much because that was the part that I really disliked. And I don't, it's kind of weird. Like a lot of people don't understand it. I just really, the day of the game was like brutal for me. It was, I wouldn't eat. I was sitting in my office with the lights out. I mean, it was weird the day of the games. And I don't miss that. And so even last year when I'm watching the game, all I'm saying to myself is, thank God I'm not there coaching it. This girl who I'm going to help, Diane Decker, Lebanon Valley is the name of the school. And I said to her, I said, look, I want something in writing that if you get sick, that I absolutely am not going to have to coach the game. I said, I just want it in some kind of writing. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's how much I don't want to coach the games anymore.
Denise Dillon, one of your former players, one of your former great players, is now the head coach, took over after you retired. What's it like having a player, you know, somebody you coached, take over the program that you ran for so long?
It's kind of a really cool thing. From a personal standpoint, it's cool because you feel like you taught her. And from a wider standpoint for the whole Villanova family, I think it's a good thing because all the players that played, like, I guess it was like I was the one that was there all the time and they came through. And now Denise is a former player. So it's like a sorority, you know, they all have something in common. And I think for me, like I said, from a personal standpoint, it's cool because I taught her. It's like my daughter. But on the wider scope, it's like happy for all the people that played at Villanova. They feel like one of their sisters now is coaching the team.
And we've talked about a lot of your success, you know, games and players. What are, when you look back at kind of the broad painting of your career, what are you most proud of?
I guess I'm most proud of the graduation rate that we had, and players went on to really do some really good things afterwards. You know, I've had a Rhodes Scholar play for me. I've had like tons of nurses, doctors, lawyers. You know, it's kind of, that's cool to me that, you know, I can call somebody up on the phone if I don't know about something, and I can always call somebody that knows about it that played for me. And to me, that's what was really special. I mean, the winning and the losing, again, I go back to Dave Gavitt. He told me a long time ago, he says, Harry, all you can try to do each year is make your team try to be better than the sum of its parts from a talent standpoint. He says, then you're going to win X amount of games and you're going to lose X amount of games. He says that, and he goes, unfortunately, society won't let us think that way because we have to think about always winning. He said, but in reality, that's what it's all about. So in reality, what you should be worried about is what the kids become as human beings afterwards down the road. He always said that winning and losing gets in the way. And he was right.
Harry Perretta, thanks so much for taking the time. This was great.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it. Talk to you.
And that will do it for this week's episode. Want to thank the great Harry Perretta, who retired as Villanova University women's basketball coach back in 2020, for being our guest this week. If you like this show and you want to help us out, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and a review. Now, you can follow the show on Twitter at @1on1pod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at @MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check in again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
What's good, y'all? It's Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP, SAG Master, and now your host of Free Range. This is where NFL meets real talk. Every week, I'm bringing you inside the game, from locker room stories to league-wide headlines. You want football IQ, locker room insight, and real conversations with the people shaping the league? Welcome to Free Range with Von Miller, where nothing is off limits and every down counts. New episodes every Wednesday. Listen and follow Free Range with me, Von Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.